As we've been studying through different parts of the story of the Old Testament, we came to the place of King David. David, where the Lord spoke to him in remarkable covenant terms. And if you were to look at so far, you might well say that all was well in the world. The kingdom of God's people was going to prosper under the leadership of David's house. But even there, remember, when God spoke to David, there was a conditional. There was an if, even there. Conditional on obedience and faithfulness to that very covenant, to God himself who gave that covenant. If you remember back, that is 2 Samuel chapter 7. It's in chapter 11 of that same book that we then read of David's sins with Bathsheba and all that follows that with Uriah, her husband, and so on. So that where God has spoken to David in covenant terms and shown a great esteem for David, a few chapters later, David himself starts the rot, shall we say. His personal life was certainly not rosy. As I said, that was in chapter 11 of 2 Samuel. And from there onwards, we read nothing but trouble, really. Trouble with a number of different sons, their attempts to take the kingdom from their own father. Yet in the middle of one of those incidents, we find the emergence of Solomon. And Solomon was Bathsheba's second child for David, and he was to be David's chosen successor. Solomon has gone down in history as a famous wise man, and perhaps because of his wisdom it became possible for him to become very rich as well. We do know that God said, because that is what you ask for, I will also give you a great name and you will have riches, because you asked for wisdom first. And under Solomon, the nation of Israel prospered. It covered the largest territory of all. It had the largest territory it had ever has covered since. But at the very same time, partly because of the way that he went about things, not only did Solomon have the largest territory of Israel, he also had the largest harem. We find a total of 1,000 women that he could call his own, wives and concubines as they're called. But for this to happen, many of them had to be foreigners, and there was ample history before Solomon to know that this only spelt trouble. Days when Balaam, for example, one of the cases that we looked at a little while ago, it was Balaam's advice. He couldn't prophesy anything against people of Israel, but he advised Moab, the people who were trying to bring Israel down, he advised them to marry into the family and to take them in marriage. And it did cause trouble. Israel started to go out after other gods. And that's exactly what happened in Solomon's day. He was led astray by these women. Or he allowed himself to be. And it's from there that today I want to look at the broken kingdom. And the various points have been listed there. To look first of all at Solomon in just a bit more detail. To look then at the division of the kingdom. To realize that the kingdom went separate ways. To see too that the kingdom brought about defilement of God's people. But the kingdom was spoken to, we've seen reference to that in the prophets. And in the end, the people were disciplined. So there is these six things that I would like to mention briefly. There's Solomon, there's the division, there are the separate ways, there's the defilement, they were spoken to, and they were disciplined. All this under the heading of the broken kingdom. Deal with Solomon first of all. As I've said, He started so well. He was blessed by the Lord. He was blessed with wisdom. And when I know the whole story of Solomon, I'm still amazed when I go back to chapter 8 of 1 Kings and I read the wonderful prayer at the opening of the temple, its dedication. A remarkable prayer, a prayer of a great leader who was devoted to God. But in the story of Solomon, within his reign of around about 40 years, in that time, he also then turned to build shrines, not just one glorious temple for the true living God, but he built shrines and temples and palaces for other gods. He did it for his wives, at least initially. But we do discover that before long, he also followed them himself. We read something of that in chapter 11, the first reading we took this evening. And it's thus that the covenant promise to David came about. The covenant promise was not just that there would be a son and that there would be a house forever, not just that this son would build a temple, but the covenant promise also included a promise that if his son committed iniquity, the result would be God's condemnation. The result would be a damage done to that very throne. And damage done to God's chosen people. A lot of it rested upon the man, the leader of God's people. And the stability, therefore, of the people, the stability in serving the Lord, it was seriously undermined by the behavior of this man, Solomon. So you see the remarkable terms that we read in chapter 11 of 1 Kings. And there you find that it was justice that was administered. Justice was to be served. It had to be done. Just in those few verses, 11 to 13. There's a therefore there. There's reason behind it. Because you have done this. It's not just a whim that God takes. It is because there is reason behind it. But other parts of the promise are also kept, the covenant, because and for the sake of my servant David, yes, the kingdom will be torn away from you and your house, but not completely. God's covenant would be maintained. But in order to achieve that, what had to come about was a division. Because of Solomon's sin, the kingdom, the people of God, people being a collective term where there needs to be a unity about it, here division was to be brought about because of that sin. For God's maintaining of his covenant with David. So that's the second thing, is the division. Now if you go to most books that write about this kind of period, they will speak about the divided kingdom. I've deliberately chosen the word broken kingdom, because I think we need to be far more aware of what has happened here. I feel that very often, and because it's been used so often, talking about the divided kingdom, it's rather antiseptic, it's rather, you know, rather calm and collected, but we need to realize that this is something that was made of God. It was made to be glorious, a glorious people, a glorious nation, and man came in and interfered, messed it up, and it's broken, it's shattered. That peace and prosperity of David's day and Solomon's day, so soon broken in one lifetime, really. 40 years of David, 40 years of Solomon. It's all evaporated. The nation has been broken. And that came about in the days of Solomon's son, Rehoboam. We didn't read of Rehoboam, we read of Jeroboam. Rehoboam was Solomon's own son. And it's only in the following chapter, chapter 12, that we read of the threat of civil war in God's own people amongst them. There was a threat of conflict that they were setting up to further their own interests, each side. I want to dwell briefly on this for a moment. I mentioned God's people, it's a singular or a collective term. God's promise to Abraham, way back then, and the very first time he made such a promise in chapter 12 of Genesis, he said, I will make you a great nation. in the singular. He does speak later with Ishmael coming along. He says he'll be a father of nations. But this is certainly not the desirable way of achieving different nations. This was to be one nation. My people, God said of Israel when he took them out of Egypt. You will be my people. And even in the day of Joshua, when there were 2.5 of the tribes said, we like this land on the east of the river, Joshua, God's man, was so concerned to emphasize that the people both stood and fell together. So when there's division, surely there was little of God in it. The people of God were broken. It takes me to think too, talking about broken, it reminds me of the tablets of the law that Moses brought down from the mountain first, and when he saw the way that Israel had gone, he broke them. He shattered those rocks, those stones. New ones were needed. But once the law was written on those new tablets of stone, the law itself was broken. And then we find when you come to the prophet Jeremiah, he speaks of a new covenant, that law being set in man's heart, a new way. Now here we're talking about kingdom. Kingdom is God's chosen way of the rule of law, that very same law. And that's at the heart of it, is that it was broken, the law of God. Because you have not adhered to my commandments, my statutes, God said repeatedly through those passages. And so the kingdom is broken. The people of God are broken down the middle. Broken by whom? Broken by the sin of Solomon. Broken by the pride of his son, Rehoboam. Broken by the ambition of Jeroboam. Broken by the dissatisfaction of the people. And not one of those terms is appealing or satisfactory. Every one of them has a problem with it. But it broke the kingdom. There was a division. The result of that, of course, is the separate ways that they went. There were two kingdoms from here on, from the days of Rehoboam in the south, leading Judah, and in the north there was what became known as Israel, the 10 tribes under initially the kingship of Jeroboam. The south was centered around Jerusalem and kings from David's line. And this was a dynasty that did indeed continue to the very end of Judah. But in the north, it was led by Jeroboam. And he becomes known as Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. These two nations went their separate ways. There was a centering around Jerusalem for many years still. And that was what we read in a couple of places, that God said, but it's for the sake of Israel where I've chosen to put my name, to place my worship. Yet Jeroboam chose to go a separate way. You know, if you go and check the story, you'll see there for very political reasons, he didn't want to lose the northern kingdom to people who might want to go back to Jerusalem to worship God. And so, and it's very, very perceptive of him to see that that might happen. So what he duly does is, in both in the north of his kingdom and in the south, he sets up a golden calf at each end, north and south. And he says, I'm going to set things up so that my people can worship the Lord here. That's never the way it finishes. These were golden calves. These were the gods of the people around them. These were fertility symbols. Persuading the people not to return to the temple in Jerusalem, he was persuading them to neglect and turn aside from God's chosen way of serving him. It was God who had promised and given him the kingdom, but very soon he approached it from a very human way. And it became a byword thereafter. If you go through the books of Kings and you read of all of the different kings of the northern kingdom, Israel, by and large you will find that the reflection on their rule is that he went in the ways of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. What a way to go down in history. To be known as the man who caused God's people to sin. And to be the mark of it. In contrast, we find in the south, the standard was David, who had a heart for God. And so the northern kingdom in particular, where there was a consistency to some degree through through Judah in the south, the northern kingdom was really something of a roller coaster, not all that far different from the days of the judges. There was a stuttering course, there was conflict, there were murders, there were coups, and so on. All the different alliances with the nations around them. And very rarely, if ever, did they truly turn to the Lord. And therefore we need to also notice especially the issue of defilement, which is perhaps, if you like, at the very heart of this whole passage. I mentioned the calves and the idols. That's where it began in the north. Although it was there, surely to some extent, from the days of Solomon, who had certainly shown no good leadership in that regard. When the man at the top erects shrines to other gods, then everyone else can too, surely. Both in the north and the south, these were all over the place. In the high places, that means just up on the hills. And very often there would be a tree there which would be regarded. Fertility was a big issue for the people there. They were so dependent upon the land. Any symbol of fertility would be a place where they would seek to make some kind of worship. But here they were just like the Canaanites that they were supposed to have pushed out of the land. And you know that the seven names, the Hittites through to the Jebusites. Where was the difference? It wasn't there at all. But those people, God had deliberately removed them, using his people Israel, he'd removed them because their sin had become to fullness. Because their defiling of the land very quickly became the norm in the northern kingdom. The south also succumbed. If you go to some of the prophets, you see them first of all talking about Israel. And you can imagine Judah listening into this and saying, yeah, look what they've, where their trouble is. But the prophets would then turn around and say, this is God's word to Judah as well. At least amongst some of the kings of Judah, of David's line, some were recognized to have done what was right. There's sort of two grades, if you like. There were some who did terrible evil. Manasseh was one that we read of in 2 Kings towards the end of the kingdom. And then there were others who did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. And then there were two or three who did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as did their father David. This was the great accolade. In the north, there were a variety of dynasties, not just the one, or just one-off kings, some of them lasting for a week. None of them lasted beyond four generations, because again and again, God speaks to them through his prophets, such as Elijah, and he says, but look what you're doing to my people. You're causing them to sin. I will not allow you to endure and your dynasty. It was because they too were going after the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. It was about defiling the land, about leading the people to serve other gods. And there were some awful things went on. Doesn't it say that about Manasseh? He's acted more wickedly. He's done these abominations. There was Molech, for example. One of the references there spoke of Milcom, probably another name for the same god. Involved child sacrifice. There was Baal, who appeared so often, and Asherah. And these were involved fertility rites. It's just what the Canaanites had done, looking to get good crops and so on. The people of Israel, of all people, went down the same route instead of trusting in the Lord. And then the things that went on around it, at prostitution and so on, horrible things. It was seen, God saw it as a defiling of his chosen land, where he had chosen to put a holy people. I'm a holy God. You too should be holy, living holy. And that means having a holy land. It would be purifying in a sense. But they were defying it in the way that they chose to go. But in that defiling, they were also spoken to. God, when he brought judgment, did not bring an unexpected judgment. It was fully anticipated before they ever entered the land. The verses included on the sheet there beside the order of service from Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 19. Let me read it. Then it shall be, if you by any means forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that you shall surely perish. As the nations which the Lord destroys before you, so you shall perish, because you would not be obedient to the voice of the Lord your God. It was there for them to be seen before they ever entered the land. And in the time of the kings that we're looking at just so briefly, these people were often reminded of this very thing. The prophets came. Didn't we read that as well? That the prophets came and spoke to the people. When we pick up the Bible and we look and we read the prophets, we often end up with them long after the history books. We don't make the connections as well as we should. But these prophets, those there from Isaiah right through to Habakkuk in the first place, these prophets fitted into this period. We need to grasp that. The northern kingdom had a shorter existence, and in that time you have prophets such as Hosea, Amos, Jonah, Micah, although he also and perhaps primarily was in Judah, Nahum possibly, because he spoke of Assyria. You also find Elijah and Elisha. God sent his prophets to preach a message. Look at the road you're going. But if you turn from that road, you do have some hope. There was the southern kingdom of Judah. Joel probably fitted in there. It was certainly Isaiah over a 60-year period. Towards the end of that time, there was Jeremiah. There was Micah, who was around the time of Isaiah as well. And there was Ezekiel and Habakkuk, most of them, of course, very close to the end of their history. A special accumulation of prophets, if you like, towards the end, when things were becoming so urgent, needing attention. But in every one of them, there were first of all the warnings about which way they were going, where it would lead. There were also the other options that were open to them. Indeed, just one other option. And that was opened out to them repeatedly. That there is still a rich hope that you can have if you follow the Lord's way. These people were spoken to again and again. I mentioned that this morning. And they really had no excuse. But ultimately, having no excuse and having not listened, the time of discipline did come. And I use that word for a reason. Because not once do I hear of Israel being treated, at least as a whole, treated as anything other than a son. That's the way God looked on Israel. Very special people. And I say it also because of the way the New Testament treats it. It tells us that God chastens and disciplines a son that he loves. The wayward son that he has a passion for, he will discipline. He seeks to bring back to himself. There were frequent intrusions by the Syrians just north of Israel. There were intrusions by the Egyptians to the south. There were eventually the Assyrians, who were very powerful, very cruel people, evil people. These were coming in, and they were God's chosen instruments to discipline his people and try to draw them back. difference if they would listen. Yet they still didn't. Discipline had to go further and further to ultimate judgment and destruction. This happened in 722 BC. Assyria was so powerful, they came in, they destroyed the northern kingdom, they took the people captive, put other people into the land from which you eventually got the Samaritans of the New Testament day. But Israel, the northern tribes, were taken away and scattered all over the place. And I don't know that very much is really known of them. Maybe things expected and suspected and proposed, but not a great deal known of them ever since. And then, some years later, 120 or so years later, in two phases, Judah was also exiled into Babylon. And that's where you come up with Daniel and so on. Perhaps I can talk about that the next time, that exile. But here it's discipline. That's where what it was about that led to that exile. That not just a breaking up of the kingdom, but a dispersal of the kingdom. It was apparently discarded, and that was indeed very difficult for them to cope with, as both Jeremiah and Ezekiel deal with. But there is, very briefly, the key elements in the story of this, what is known as the divided kingdom. I call it the broken kingdom, the period from Solomon through to the exile of the nations of Israel and Judah. It's a story of the rebellious heart of man not learning. We do need to remember that this is a period of about 400 years, and it's 400 years to see that decline. Sometimes there were notable incidents which saw a rapid decline. But for many people, it may have seemed to be rather imperceptible. It's only when you take snapshots beginning and end that you realize just how far you've gone down the incline. Just as it is today. We do need to learn from this today ourselves, as God's own people, that it needs constant work, constant attention. It would be good perhaps to take a glimpse at someone like Josiah, but who rediscovered the law, who read it, who was stricken by it, who sought to restore and to reform the people of Judah around the temple. It needs work, it needs attention to remember God's law. And certainly this is a model of the way that God does work with his people. How often might we be inclined to say with Hezekiah, Hezekiah did something and the Lord condemned him for it. He had done a lot of good, but there was something that God said, because you've done this, he showed his kingdom to the Babylonians, he said, all of this that you've shown them will become theirs, they will take it over. But not just yet. And Hezekiah almost seems to have breathed a sigh of relief and said, well, at least it's not going to happen in my time. How often that can be done? It was obviously too late by then for him to have done anything about it. But his own son was Manasseh, this awful king. We need to realize, too, that what this story is telling us is that the covenant curses were as real as the promises, the good promises, the ones that we love to hear. And this is a pointer to the response to Jesus, who is the great son of the covenant, the great son of David, whom the Lord was looking towards even then. But he's made the same word concerning that son, as he did concerning Solomon, concerning his approach to this everlasting throne. There's yet a curse involved in that. But where there is iniquity amongst his people, judgment must come, must be dealt with. Thank you. Again, my endeavor is to set out before you some of the key elements in this passage of the history recorded for us in Scripture, to give us some context too in which to fit, especially passages such as the prophets, but also that we do learn through the course of what happened here, that it can be found, much the same course can be found in microcosm, in an individual life. And as I said already, how important it is, therefore, to hold fast, to work at maintaining right relationship with God, and not to be divided from Him, not to defile our lives, but rather to turn to Him in all that we do, to take heed to His word, and to His discipline, should that come, that we ourselves will not be discarded, as was the nation of Israel, as a result of all of this. So may God bless His word to us this evening, this brief glimpse that we take of it together. May we pray together.